Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute. It's time to begin.
Here's what we're going to do. If it's okay, I'm going to do a little talk. Then we're going to have a pop quiz with prizes. And there are also fines for wrong answers. Did they tell you that coming in? There's going to be a tip jar. Put in anything you're comfortable with, but C notes are nice. And then after that, we'll do the Q&A. Does that sound? And then signing. Or do you want the reverse? Okay. All right. So one day, we're going to talk about the Chet and Bernie series. One day, my wife said, you should do something with dogs. Now, I'd had dogs in other work that I'd done, where a dog would appear and be in a scene or two, but you never saw from inside the dog, right? They were in the third person. For example, I wrote a book called Oblivion, and in it there was a dog called Buster, who in fact, I think he was singled out by the reviewer of the LA Times, I'm not going to tell you what he said, because I just came very close to quoting from my own reviews. Like, you thought maybe I was going to do that and humiliate myself. Really, I was brought up better than that, but writers do it all the time. The first time I saw it, I was at the ALA, at the American Library Association, I think, in South Florida. We were on stools at this, and this writer next to me started quoting from his own reviews. And I almost fell off my stool, which writers can do easily anyway, with our bad sense of balance and too much drinking. But he started to quote from his own review, And then as I listened, I could tell that if you knew anything about reviews, you knew that his weren't even that good. You could hear the dot, dot, dots going by where he'd taken out all the qualifiers, right? Okay, so that was a digression that isn't going to be on the test. And I'm going to digress off that digression, and then we'll start the talk. So we're now eliminating the Q&A because of that. Sorry. I do quote from one review. Years ago, I was asked if I'd be willing to write for children, if I was interested in writing for children. The Chet and Bernie series, although teenagers are reading them, this is not for children. But here's another digression. Next summer, Scholastic asked me if I would be interested in writing a middle graders, like a dog-narrated mystery series for middle graders. So Woof, W-O-O-F, book one of the series, comes out next summer. And there'll be a new Chet and Bernie as well. Anyway, So I wrote for children, and before the first book came out, the publicist said, "Would you be willing to go into the schools?" And I said, "Well, yeah, because that's where the kids are, you know, held captive, and we can sell them books. This is America." And so she said to me, "Well, you know, think about your answer, because a lot of our writers don't like to go into the schools." And I said, "Why not?" And she said, "Well, they're not really that comfortable around kids. These are children's book writers, right?" I said, "I have four of my own. Send me into the school." So Down the Rabbit Hole was the first book in the Echo Fall series that I wrote. And it was for fifth through eighth grade. So I was in the Midwest somewhere. And before the talk, a teacher came up to me and she said, "We have some gifted third graders who've read your book. Can they please come to the talk?" And I said, "Yeah," because I wanted to see what gifted third graders looked like. So at the end of the talk, up came these five tiny people. And the red-haired boy with the glasses and freckles looked up at me and he said, "I read your book. It was pretty good." Pretty good is the only review that I quote. I want it on my tombstone, I think. But, you know, one thing, it comes from a certified gifted critic, and not every writer can say that. Okay, all of that was a digression. You can forget it completely. So one day my wife said, remember when I was starting a while, "Is it dark out yet?" And a funny thing about writing novels, sometimes 6 months worth of work can happen in 30 seconds. The reverse is also true. So if you've got like a paying job right now, I wouldn't jump into this. But I knew within 30 seconds these three things. One, I wanted to write a series narrated by a dog. Two, I wanted to do a series that was basically one of the oldest forms of mystery, and that is the kind where the sidekick tells the story about what the detective is doing in the first person. It goes all the way back to Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson. It's one of the, it isn't the earliest, but it's one of the very earliest mystery forms. And three, this is the most important thing. If the Chet and Bernie series works, it's because of this. This dog, okay, who's Chet? I'm not giving anything away, I don't think, to say that the dog is Chet and Bernie is the detective. This dog was not going to be a talking dog. He was not going to be a human in a dog suit. He wouldn't be knowing and ironic. He wouldn't know about Mozart. He would only know what dogs... He would be as purely... No talking. Not a talking dog. As purely canine as I could make him. But if you know dogs at all and have spent time with them, you know they have a narrative going on in their heads. That's what I wanted on the page. Okay, so... All right, so... Less time has elapsed in real time when my wife said this than it has gone by now. She said you should do something with dogs. We have a house and then a detached garage, and over it is the room where I write. So it's like a 15-foot commute, but important psychologically. So, okay, so she said you should do something with dogs. I went over. Okay, I finished my drink. I went over to the office, you know, and I wrote what became the first page of Doggone It, which is book one in the series. Paw and Order, the book we're talking about tonight, is the seventh. And I wrote it, and maybe it took, I don't know, 20 minutes, something like that. I went back home into the kitchen. My wife, yes, isn't it crazy? That's how I think of it. I mean, and I say, I'm going home now. Like I'm on the phone with my agent or something, and I say, I'm going home. What the hell are you talking about? She said, you're home. You know, so she's in New York. She has this horrible train ride every night. So I went back. My wife read it over. And we voted 2-0 that it worked. So a good thing none of the kids were home. Because we could have lost 4-2. And there'd be no Chet and Bernie mystery series. One thing I discovered. Sometimes, you know, these are little journeys when you're writing a book. I discovered things as I began to write this series. The plotting of a mystery novel is very similar to the solving of a real crime. You sift through a whole lot of clues and line them up in a logical order and conclude something. Well, Chet can't do that. And even if he could, when an important clue in the chain is about to be revealed, he might sniff a Cheeto under a sofa and he's gone. And you don't get that clue. So he turns out to be an unreliable narrator, which is great because usually to do that, you have to get an MFA degree and go to writing school, which I never did. Nevertheless, I stumbled into this. And to marry the unreliable narrator to this traditional mystery form that I was talking about is challenging, but also has payoffs that are kind of interesting. And anything that's challenging and has interesting payoffs keeps things fresh for the writer. And it's really good if you don't have to try to fake the freshness in the story, especially in a series, because I'm sure you've all read series books where number two isn't quite as good, but you still like it, and then number three, and then you're sensing the effort behind it. See, and as soon as you're sensing the effort, there's trouble. I'm not saying there is an effort behind this, but because of this structure and the unreliability of the narrator and also this voice of Chet, which I just love doing, I mean, it feels fresh to me every time, you know, that I'm going to be writing it. Before Doggone It came out, the publisher said to me, would you be willing to do some social media? And after they explained what that was, I said, I'll take a swing at it. So out of that developed ChetTheDog.com and Chet's Facebook page and on Twitter. And these have been very interesting experiences. One of the things that happened, excuse me, I'm just going to take another. Almost right away, people began sending in pictures to both those places of their dogs, and not just dogs, but cats and birds and hamsters and gerbils, stuffed animals also, by the way. So, and these are coming in a lot. They're inundating. So I said to the publisher, you know, we should have some kind of drawing where each month one is picked to be Chet's friend of the month, and then the human companion will get a signed and paw-printed copy of the latest book. I have my paw-printing kit here tonight in case anyone wants a signed book. So a random number generator every month picks this winner. Now, what I'm about to tell you has to stay in this room, okay? It's a secret. A random number generator does pick all these, but I see these pictures going by. And let's say, like at a book signing quite like this, someone says, oh, I've got this really cute dog, Jerry. And then a few days later, I see Jerry come in. A thumb can be put on the scale. Okay, you didn't hear it here. The second best thing that ever happened in my career happened because of that blog. You know these patchwork quilts that can be made, like one person makes one and one another? A group of people at the blog, Chet.com, made this whole patchwork quilt about the Chet and Bernie series. Little, with dog biscuits and baseballs. And one day it just showed up at my house. It hangs in a place of honor in my office. And I think tonight, there's someone here who I've never met, but who is very active at the blog and is one of the earliest and biggest fans of the whole series. And if Shelley from Greeley is here tonight, I'd like her to stand up, please. Thank you. Thank you, Shelley. Thank you very much. So that was the second best thing that happened in my career. So now you know, I've told you to this, you know, this little secret. All right, let's get to Paw in Order, which is book 7 in the series. People say, should it be read in any particular order? That's not a question Chet would ask. Okay? You can just jump right in. Now, Paw in Order is book... Okay, I have to hold it up, by the way, because if you don't, Simon & Schuster fines me. Like, just the way I'm going to fine you for wrong answers. Like, it's just, I'm past all that cash, just goes right to the publisher. That, by the way, is how publishing works nowadays. It's that type of thing. Okay, Paw in Order, 7th book in the series. Now, Chet and Bernie live in what Chet knows only as the Valley for the first 5 books of the series, from Doggone It to A Fistful of Collars. He lives in the Valley because that's how people refer to it around him. If you know Arizona at all, you know it's got to be Arizona. It's a big metropolis that's never named, surrounded by vast wilderness. So it's Phoenix-like, but it has more of the vibe of Tucson. But it never says. In book 6, The Sound and the Furry is the first book where Chet and Bernie leave the Valley and go on the road. It's the book before this. What happens is, I'll just do a digression on The Sound and the Furry. Chet and Bernie are out riding in their old Porsche. I think by that time it's the 3rd Porsche in the series. The first one went off a cliff, and each one is more decrepit and dinged up than the last. The first one went off a cliff, the second one was blown up, and now they're on their 3rd. So they're out riding, and they come upon one of those inmate work crews in orange jumpsuits. Well, when Chet and Bernie see one of those, they always slow down because there's a good chance they know somebody. And in this case, it's Frenchie Boutette. They know Frenchie. So they have a little chat with Frenchie by the side of the road. And Frenchie tells them this story. He's a Cajun from Louisiana, and he's a black sheep in a family that's all black sheep, except for one white sheep brother, Ralph, who's gone missing. And Frenchie would like to hire Chet and Bernie to go find Ralph. Well, Chet looks at Frenchie and, you know, sees no pockets in that jumpsuit, so what are they going to pay with? You know, because Chet and Bernie's finances are poor. So they go home, but that night there's a knock on the door. And they open it, and it's a certain type of woman, the kind of woman that Bernie doesn't do well with. Her name is Vanna. She says that she's Frenchie's wife, and she hands over $3,000 in cash to get them to go to Louisiana. Chet notices that it smells of shrimp. That's the first clue in the case. Now, see, this is one of the things, you know, Chet, this is really important. Chet, these novels are written with the sense of smell and hearing more important than the visual. So it's this; these books are really like classic form, but played on an unusual instrument. Because, so in many ways, Chet is way ahead of Bernie, right? And Bernie's a puzzle to him, because Bernie's nose is not small. But what's it for? So, and people say, how much, well, we'll get to the questions. You'll probably ask this, so we'll skip on. Okay, so they end up going in the Sound and the Fury to Louisiana. And they're questioning a witness. Bernie's questioning a witness on page 93. And the witness, hearing Bernie speak, says, this is in Louisiana, the witness says, you're not from around here, are you? And Bernie says, no, we're from Arizona. And the next line, it's all Chet narrating, of course. Bernie says, no, we're from Arizona. And the next line is, ha, huh, we were from Arizona. I'd wondered about that. So on page 93 of book 6 in the series, Chet finally finds out. And this is the long kind of thread you can, not that I know anything about weaving, but that would never stop me from using it as a metaphor. This is the long kind of thread you can put in a long series. Each book has to be self-contained and satisfying, but there are things you can set up that can be resolved later. For example, the little puppy that resembles Chet, that's appeared a few times in the book I'm writing now, plays more of a role. So, at the end of The Sound and the Fury, Chet and Bernie are leaving Louisiana, and I pick it up exactly there, and the very conversation that ends The Sound and the Fury, but you don't have to read The Sound and the Fury, is repeated verbatim here, only the meaning of it seems quite different. It's just a little Rashomon moment, you know, the Japanese movie, as though Samuel Beckett was writing Chet for a little bit. Forget all that. It's not important. with an Irish accent, right? So they're about to leave Louisiana. They come to a crossroads. To turn left is to go back home to Arizona. To turn right would be to go to Washington, where Susie is. Susie is Bernie's girlfriend. She used to live in the Valley. She's a reporter, a crack reporter for the Valley Tribune. Got this job offer from the Washington Post and took it. Bernie said, even though it was a lot of angst because of what it was going to do to their relationship, Bernie said, you have to take it. It's a no-brainer. And I believe Chet remarks to himself that no-brainers are his favorite kind of brainer. So they go to Washington. But, you know, Bernie, as I mentioned before, he's no expert when it comes to women. So that one sort of, it would be obvious to a lot of people that you call ahead to tell Susie you're coming, that gets skipped. So that he knocks on the door, and only then does he realize that maybe his prep hasn't been good enough. So he snatches out some flowers out of the flower bed to give her as a gift, you know. And so, you know, the dirt is dropping off the roots. And the door opens. And it's not Susie. It's this urbane, well-dressed British man named Eben St. John. And he's turning backwards to call to Susie back in the house, goodbye, love. So Bernie interprets that as meaning that Susie has a romantic interest in this person, when in fact, he's only a source. A source for an international story with implications in a U.S. presidential election. But we don't know that yet, that Susie's working on the biggest story of her life. Not long after, this gentleman, Eben St. John, something not good happens to him. And the instrument of that not good happening is something that was in Bernie's possession. Okay, that's the way it's... Now, I don't want to give any more weight. What I do want... I want to thank Vladimir Putin, but only within the small framework of, you know, not generally as a role model for all of us. But his recent, what would you call them, actions have made, and I had no idea this was coming from him because we're not in communication whatsoever, that his recent actions have made this story much more timely. And I'm actually thinking of inscribing a copy to him and sending it to the Kremlin. Just, dear Vlad, you came through for me big time, but enough is enough. Something like that, because the book is out now. He can't do me any more favors. So what I wanted to do was write a John le Carré, Graham Greene kind of thing seen through the eyes of a dog. Okay, and when I mentioned that to one of my tennis buddies, he said, "Are you nuts?" So what I'm going to do now is, if it's all right, I'm going to read a short scene from the book, and you can be the judge. Do you mind a short reading? Because sometimes readers just loathe that. I don't know why, because it's a book that we're talking about. But I have to take off my glasses to do this. I don't know why. It's 40 or 50 pages. It'll go by pretty quick. So it requires a brief setup. Early in the book, Chet, looking out a window, notices this strange bird hovering outside the window. Now, if you've read anything in the series, you know Chet he's not fond of birds. They have mean little eyes, and he knows that if he could soar around in the great blue sky, he would not have mean little eyes. So he looks, and this bird is hovering. Just hovering motionless out the window. But this is a very strange bird. For example, it's not flapping anything to hover, and it has no eyes at all. So he barks, and Bernie ignores him. Later in the book, they're outdoors somewhere. The strange bird appears hovering again. Chet barks again. This time, Bernie does look, but before he can, the strange bird has gone behind a tree, and he doesn't see it. So we're going to read now the third time that the strange bird enters the story. It's Maryland or Virginia. I can't remember because they've been following through in some lead, but now they've taken a pit stop, okay? And this is what happens there. Can you hear me all right, by the way? Okay. Bernie straightened, turned to me. "What are you barking about?" he said. "The strange bird, of course. What could be more obvious? I amped it up." "What? What? You needed a pit stop. We took a pit stop. Thirsty, maybe?" Bernie reached back into the car, dug out my portable bowl and a bottle of water, filled the bowl, laid it on the grass beside me. I have a thing I sometimes do, hard to say why or even describe, that involves backing up with my legs real stiff and barking in a quick rat-a-tat-tat machine gun way that's hard to ignore. "Drink, for the love of God." "You're not thirsty? What do you want?" Bernie raised his hands, looked up, spoke to the sky, a human thing you see from time to time, the sky never answering. In my experience. "What does he want? What the hell does..." Bernie froze, his gaze at last on the strange bird. I went silent. It got very quiet in our little pit stop area. Nothing to hear but the faint whir-whir of the strange bird. Bernie watched the bird. I watched Bernie. At first his face looked surprised. Then his mouth opened very slightly, a sign he was understanding something. Next his eyes got hard. He glanced at me. "Good boy, Chet. Way ahead of me again, huh?" "Of course not. How could anyone ever be ahead of Bernie?" Bernie opened the trunk of the Porsche and took out the tire iron. That was unexpected. We were going to do some work on the car? Were we even having any problems with it lately? Not that I'd noticed. And the truth is that car repairs are not our best thing. You wouldn't believe how long it takes to get a coat like mine clean if it happens to get splashed with all the oil that's in the tank, and then some. But if Bernie said car repairs, then car repairs it would be. Except now, he was stepping away from the car, his head tilted up, his eyes back on the strange bird. He patted the end of the tire iron once, twice on his open hand, and then came maybe the most exciting moment of my career, so far. Bernie drew back his throwing arm. He's got a cannon, as I must have made clear by now if I'd been doing my job, and flung that tire iron high in the sky. It spun up there, glittering in the sunshine and whirling so fast I could hear the rush of air closing and closing on the strange bird, which just went on hovering, maybe too stupid to know that big trouble was on the way. On the way with bells on, amigo. Whatever that might mean. My apologies for even throwing it in there. And then, whack! What a lovely sound. Solid, metallic, satisfying. The strange bird came down in a jerking spiral and landed right beside us with a jangly thud. Easy, big guy, easy, Bernie said. Uh-oh. Was I jumping up and down? I made my best effort to get that under control, at least eliminating the up part of the jump, if that makes any sense. Meanwhile, Bernie was crouched over the strange bird, which was now in pieces, more than two, and not a bird at all, or even a creature of any kind, but a machine with insides that reminded me a bit of the insides of Bernie's desktop computer, the day that Charlie figured out how to get the back off. The fun we'd had. And I'd ended up pooping out that one missing piece, a little green plastic square, if I remember right, the very next day. So no harm, no foul. But no time for any of that now. Eye on the ball, big guy, which is what Bernie always says. Although when it comes to playing fetch, all our tennis balls and lacrosse balls are covered in my scent. So nose on the ball gets it done for me. Thank you. So that's the drone scene from Paw and Order, and I sort of think you can do NSA-related literature from the viewpoint of a dog. All right, we'll now get to... Oh, I better talk in front of here. It's a podcast. We're going to get to the pop quiz portion of the evening. So what we have here is five prizes, four of which really I would apologize for, but one is pretty good. And, well, this year all I have for... I have very nice bookmarks, which are the first four prizes. I'll hold one up. Chet and Bernie bookmarks are sort of thick and not on cheap recycled paper. This is your lucky night, right? And the fifth prize is a Chet and Bernie Frisbee for the hardest question. Now, the way we do this is, like, I'll read out a question and just put up your hands, and I'll try to recognize whoever's first. If I don't, I mean, let's not have legal action or anything like that. Please. All right, question one. Everybody, this is like high school, isn't it? Like, first we were sort of having fun and in this beautiful day, and now there's going to be one of those bubble tests, right? And then at the end, you're not going to an Ivy League school. I mean, that's the way the curve bends on this. Yep. Okay, number one. What?
What's the penalty for missing?
Oh, fines. Yeah. Fine. So, yeah, but I said earlier, it's whatever you want to... Okay, so it can, but, you know, don't embarrass yourself with something small. I mean, that's, okay. No, I mean, that's just general human, you know, how to, you know, behavior. All right, number one, what is the nation within the nation? Yes, ma'am, in the front row. Dogs. Dogs, there are 75 to 80 million dogs in this country. Who came up with that phrase? Who coined that phrase? Who talks about the nation within the nation? Bernie, but you don't get a prize because she, but that, no, here, you get the prize, congratulations, but don't feel 100% great about it because she bailed you on who it was. So I get asked this quite a lot. That phrase, people will say, the nation within the nation, I looked at Wikipedia and I can't find where you got that. So... You know, it's a funny thing. As I mentioned before, I don't have an MFA degree. My mother taught me almost everything I know about writing when I was a kid. But I know friends who have gone to writing school. They learn a lot about structure and plot and building character, but imagination doesn't seem to come up very often, which just happens to be the chainsaw in the toolkit, right? So the true answer, and I hope I'm not saying this in an egocentric way, is I thought up The Nation Within the Nation. There are no ghostwriters involved in the Chet and Bernie mystery series. And don't get me started on ghostwriters. All right, here we go. Second question. These get maybe a little harder. The second question is, who is Peanut? Do we have a reply? That boy in the back behind. The elephant. Exactly. Do you remember the name? You don't have to remember anymore. In the book To Fetch a Thief. Why don't you come on up, because you probably don't need a hip replacement, and I do. And
congratulations. Excellent. Yeah, Peanut is...
Thank you. Peanut, in To Fetch a Thief, I wanted something very big to be missing. So Peanut the elephant goes missing. You know, I don't make an outline, an A through Z outline, not that you'd be interested. I just hate when writers go on and on about their process. But now I'll do that for a second. I just make sure I know a few big scenes along the way. They're like lighthouses, right? They shine, and first the light is very weak, and as I get closer and closer, and then when I'm there and you get energized from it. So I knew before I started To Fetch a Thief that there was going to be a scene where Chet and Peanut the elephant would be in an extreme situation all by themselves, just the two of them, in dire circumstances, and they would be forced to cooperate. So that was my lighthouse scene, and that's Peanut. Incidentally, here's another thing having to do with imagination. I'm going to tell you because it happened. That's the only reason. Two or three years ago, I was at a book signing in Seattle, and a guy came up to me at the end, and he said, "I'm the elephant guy at the zoo here." Okay, and I thought, oh my God, I better leave now. And he said, you got the elephant right. Okay, and I've never really been one-on-one with an elephant. So that's the kind of reward that can happen in this kind of career. Okay, third question, somewhat similar, but I think probably a little harder. Who is Iko? I-K-O.
The alligator?
Iko is the alligator and the sound and the furry. Congratulations. One of the things my mother taught me is empty out the mind. When you have an idea, don't just take a few exploratory spadefuls, empty it out. So, and push everything as far as it can be pushed. So as soon as I knew that that story, The Sound of the Furry, is going to take place in Louisiana, I knew that Chet would have a nemesis there. You know, the enemy was waiting, and it would be a legendary gator that they have down the swamps, and I chose the name Iko, from that song, Iko Iko, which is a very well-known Mardi Gras song, going way, way back, probably to the 19th century, actually. And so that was all set up, and I knew that they would have some kind of confrontation in Iko's watery realm. Incidentally, on names, I can't write a character until I've got the name. When I went over to my office to write that first scene I was telling you about, the name Chet came to me right away, and Bernie as well. And one of the things I liked is, Chet's name is kind of more dignified. Accepting Bernie, okay, Bernie out of the equation. This is question four. Bernie is not the answer. Who is Chet's best pal? Sir?
Charlie.
Lady in the back.
Iggy,
please come forward. Iggy, next door to Chet and Bernie live on Mesquite Road in the valley, and next door are this old couple, the Parsons. They got an electric fence salesman, sold them an electric fence to keep Iggy in, but they never got it working properly. Now Iggy doesn't even get out of the house. And so whenever we see him, he's at his window going like this, and Chet and Bernie drive off in the Porsche and having their adventures, and Iggy is like that. Except for, do you know about these short stories in the series? Okay, There are three of them. This summer's is Tale of Vengeance, T-A-I-L. These are 99-cent downloading. That's all about the title bomb divorce, which is the worst case I ever had. And I thought I would just write that up. So that's out now. But last summer, it was the Iggy Chronicles Volume 1, in which Iggy does get out and becomes actually the hero of the story. So if you want to follow Iggy more, he's got his own little, you know, it's the way, what was it? Where there's a spinoff almost. But just, there won't be too much of that. Okay, but in it. All right, we now come to question 5, the hardest question. What is the theme of the Chet and Bernie stories? Yes. They are mysteries, yes. But what is, yes.
Dog mysteries?
They are dog mysteries, sir.
Friendship.
Can we push that a little farther? Whoa, did the word love just come? Okay, and can we put names to the man and the dog? The love between blank and blank. Yeah, that's it. The love between Chet and Bernie.
So that,
the love between Chet and Bernie is the engine that drives these stories. Not all novels actually have an engine that drives the story, but it's good if it does. Because it's novels that have an engine often have a spirit. And I love when the book, there's a spirit of the book. I was on a panel at the Tucson Book Festival 2 or 3 years ago. I go pretty much every, it's a great festival and I recommend it if you're interested. So there were three writers and someone in the audience said, "What about writer's block?" And the two writers bemoaned it and said, "Oh, they get it and it's terrible." And I said, "I've never had it." And people said, "Why not?" I knocked on wood, but I said, "I never had it." Why? Because if ever I think I'm about to be stuck, I step back and I think of the engine that drives the story. So in the Chet and Bernie series, if I'm not sure what to do, I step back, I think about the love between Chet and Bernie, and some narrative route suggests itself. The love between Chet and Bernie. That's what this series is about. Well, you've been a wonderful audience. Thank you so much for coming, and I'm happy to take any questions. Or none is good. Sir. The question is about a Chet and Bernie movie. It's been in development from before Doggone It came out. It's been through several producers and at least one studio. I don't know any. But if you're like one of those Wall Street guys who actually controls, what, then let's talk after. No, it's, I don't know. You know, they have their own process. And I've had one book I wrote was made into a movie. It was called The Fan. It was a crime fiction story about baseball. Robert De Niro played the fan. And okay, again, don't repeat this. Well, you guys can keep a secret. I can just tell from your faces. But the movie didn't get the baseball right. That is the, if you don't get that right in a book that where it's all about baseball, a very nice thing that happened to me after the book The Fan came out. Well, two things. Oh, we're going way over time, right? Is that what you're?
We have 5 minutes, so.
Okay. Forget what I was saying, and let's go to another question. Yes, young lady, you. Yeah, the lady in the back would like to know more about Chet when he was a puppy, and I think he has one early memory of being crowded in a little ball of puppies, and that's all that's happened so far. I don't think I'm going to go back and write anything, except for a cat was involved, which is the first short story. I'm not going to write anything else from earlier. But in terms of Bernie and what he did in the war, which, you're right, has come up several times, in Paw and Order, There's a general with presidential ambitions. And Bernie, we find out a lot about what Bernie did in the past and why every time he runs into one of these old ex-servicemen, they give him a big hug. We find out about that in Pawn Order. That's an excellent question. Thank you. Were there others? Yes, ma'am.
We've listened to the books on disc, and we just love Jim Frangione.
You like how he does it.
Oh, yeah.
I agree with you.
Is there
going to
be a book on disc coming out for this book?
It should be out already. Pawn Order should be out. It's certainly out on Audible. Whether, you know, audible.com where you can download it. You're talking about an actual disc?
Yeah, we checked
out. Yeah, I don't know. I think so. Because I just saw the cover art of it today. Yeah. Yes, in the back, sir. Are you all going home in one car? Or? Okay, the question is, what kind of dog is Chet? The answer is, all he knows, because everything is through his reporting, all he knows is that he's 100-plus pounder, so he's big, and that his ears don't match. And he only knows that because some woman was rude enough to speak about his appearance in front of him. He's a mix. He's a 100-plus pounder. I would say that he probably has German Shepherd, and Border Collie would be two things he probably has in him. And he's very good in the water. Even though he comes to swimming late, he loves the water, and he's late to it. But that's the best. I hope that satisfies the family and keeps it together, because I'm a big believer in the intact family. And if I'd done anything to stop that, I'd be upset. Were there other questions? Yes, sir. My mother was an actual writer. She wrote for TV. She taught me everything I know by the time I was 12 years old, I would say, about writing. But she died long before I became a writer, so she never actually knew that it had taken.
I think she'd like...
You think she'd like Chet and Bernie? Thank you. That's very nice. Oh, she'd find... There'd be things. There'd be things. You know, she was fun. You know, she had a thing... If someone was telling her something that they had told her already, my mom would just hold up her fingers how many times she'd heard it from them already. Okay, yes, we'll do last question.
How and when did you become a writer at what point in life?
I became a writer. I haven't done much. I worked as a spear fisherman in college in the Bahamas, and then after I graduated, as a summer job, and then after I graduated... and then I worked briefly in radio and then came to writing. There are a lot of good things about writing. You don't have to work with other people. And also, the risk of sudden death, which you have in spearfishing because it's all breath-holding, isn't there. There's no one in the Bahamas my age spearfishing for a living right now, I can guarantee. Anyway, thank you all so much. I have my... Thank you. Thanks.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.